It's difficult to know where to start with this extraordinary Irish woman. Do we start with the silent newsreel of her as a 90-year-old woman in her New York apartment when her life was, what, nearing the end? Yet she was just about to realize she was famous.
The strange story of a 94-year-old woman in New York whose 1897 novel, The Gadfly, is a Soviet literary sensation.
But when she was discovered in New York, there was just a huge acclaim. It was front page on Pravda. Voynich lives.
Or do we start with her birth in County Cork to a famous father?
Ethel Voynich, as she became, was the youngest daughter of George Boole.
Or with her childhood illness? Or with the cryptic manuscript that bears her husband's name, the Voynich manuscript?
The Voynich manuscript deciphering should be fairly easy, but for over 100 years, people have tried and failed completely.
Or do we start when she was a young, idealistic woman on her way to St. Petersburg to get involved in revolutionary activities? Yes, let's start there before we get to the music, the mysteries, and the manuscripts. Do you believe in fate?
Haven't I seen you somewhere before?
A woman in black. She often wore black.
Her tragic nature had encouraged her to dress in black, and she had flowing golden hair, so probably fairly unmistakable.
The scene is Warsaw, 1887.
She had walked into the great square.
It's very cinematic.
It was a film noir before film noir was invented.
It's Easter Sunday.
And facing her was this dark, brooding building. The Citadel. And it was a prison at the time.
The Citadel is a fortress, a prison built by the Russian Tsar. It can house up to 3,000 prisoners, but we're only interested in one of them.
Well, unbeknownst to her, a group of prisoners were looking out the window, and they saw this striking young woman standing in the courtyard.
And it was there that the guy she was to meet later and eventually marry, Wilfried, had seen her from his prison cell down below. So it's an incredibly romantic story, because there's all sorts of fables and stories and romances in the whole of Ethel Voynich's life.
Haven't I seen you somewhere before?
I saw you from my Citadel prison room. I saw you.
That was writer and biographer Pamela Blevins and Jerry Kennedy, a descendant of Ethel Boole, better known now as Ethel Voynich. They'll stay with us as we learn more about this mysterious meeting and Ethel's life a little later. But first, a bit of background on Ethel from historian Angela Byrne.
So Ethel was born in Ballintemple, County Cork, in 1864. And what's really interesting is her kind of family background and her parentage.
Ethel's father is the celebrated mathematician George Boole, associated with University College Cork.
And her mother was really fascinating as well. She's Mary Everest. And yes, her uncle was the person who Mount Everest is named after. But Ethel's father died when she was only about 10 months old. She was a really small infant. So her mother was left with no choice but to kind of go back to London to be near family networks. And she really made a go of it as a kind of a single mother in Victorian London. And she was a kind of an early feminist writer.
Clearly, Mary Boole was a very brilliant woman, and she eventually taught mathematics at Queen's College. But the other thing about Mary Boole, there were a lot of intellectuals coming to the house, so Ethel would sit by and she would hear all these intellectuals and these conversations, gifted people talking. And so Mary Boole was a woman quite far ahead of her time, and she expressed ideals and ideas that were kind of alien to Victorian minds and culture.
Alana Hopkin is a novelist, travel writer and critic. She has researched Ethel Voynich's life.
I would imagine Mary Everest was probably one of the world's worst housekeepers. She was an intellectual in a time when women weren't meant to be intellectuals, and she had difficulty fitting in, and she certainly had difficulty running a house.
But Ethel, we really don't know what happened to her in her early days. What we do know, which seems to be a traumatic and formative period in her life, was she had this disease, rabid infection of the skin, and she was sent away to live in a classic Dickensian style with an uncle, Charles, in a place called Rainford up in Lancashire, who was the manager of a coal mine. He was a real disciplinarian, which does all a little bit sound like Oliver Twist or something.
It turned out to be a disaster. The uncle was a sadist who forced her to play the piano for hours and hours and tormented her. And of course, she gave as good as she got. She was very high-spirited.
He was pretty cruel to her. She was stubborn and willful, and she got locked away, and she got treated very badly by this guy and never forgave this wicked uncle.
One time he claimed that she had stolen something and that he would threaten to put chemicals in her mouth to make her confess to crimes he had perceived she had committed, which of course she hadn't done.
She fought back every inch of the way, and to the point where her uncle decided she was a bad influence on his own children. They were obviously getting ideas that you could fight back to this tyrant.
She was so difficult and so persistent and so strong-willed that he realized he couldn't break her iron will. He finally gave up and said, she has to go back to you. So he sent her back to her mother.
When she came back to London, not surprisingly, she had a breakdown of some sort.
And I think that as much as anything else, being separated from my mother, who she had an ambiguous relationship with, nevertheless very close, and her other four sisters, who she was also very close to, I think really, you know, soured her whole life, made it unnecessarily tragic and doom-laden and a little bit bitter.
It's during this period that she starts to wear black all the time as well, and as she said later on in life, in mourning for the state of the world.
This idea of justice, because Charles has been very unjust to her, stuck with her for all her life. It was her guiding principle, justice in the world. And she had a rather sour view from then on about the way the world not only treated her, but the way the world treated itself.
As well as dressing in black, she starts to call herself by her middle name, Lily. And you'll hear her referred to as both Lily and Ethel. In spite of being forced to play the piano, it doesn't turn her against music. In fact, she wins a scholarship to study music in Germany.
But it was just before she departed for Berlin that the assassination of the Tsar by the anarchists in Russia took place in 1881. She later on wrote, and these are her words, "The assassination of Alexander II in March 1881, when I was not yet 17 years old, made a huge impression on me." And then she gets to Berlin and she's to study music there. But we know that while she was there, she becomes interested in radicalism, in anarchism and atheism. If you think about her being located there in the centre of Europe, kind of at the crossroads of where the Russian radical thought and other European radical thoughts are all kind of crisscrossing and intersecting, and she's kind of almost at the centre of those transactions geographically. So she kind of experiences the culmination of her radical transformation during that period.
She goes back to London after Berlin. She's now fully qualified as a musician, and she can teach, which is useful because she has to earn a living.
So all these Russian emigres are starting to appear in London, and a lot of them are kind of nihilists, anarchists, they're radical revolutionaries, and really what they want is kind of a total overthrow of the structures of Imperial Russia.
Lily would meet that sort of people in her mother's house, and most importantly, she read a book called Underground Russia by Stepniak. He was living in London. He had to leave Russia because he killed the head of the Secret Service with a dagger in the street. He was some character. But he somehow arrived in London and was taken up by a very interesting set of people.
She becomes particularly friendly with Stepniak and his wife and takes Russian lessons with them, with a view to travelling to Russia.
Because she's an intellectual person and an inquisitive thinker, she says, I want to go see for myself. Are things really as bad as they say?
In April 1887, Ethel sets off for Russia.
And she got an introduction, luckily, from Stepniak's wife to her sister, who was a doctor. And off she went on her own. And she was, by then, she was still only 18 or 19.
She gets work with a noble family, teaching music and English.
because this was a noble family, they were very well connected. And the Tsar was actually godfather to the children in the house. So she met him. Now, she later on said, "We couldn't stand each other." But we'll never know the extent of conversation that they had. But she didn't stay very long in that house, no more than a few months.
This noble family are based about 500 miles south of Moscow. And when she leaves them, her journey upriver to the city creates a lifelong passion for folk music.
From a music point of view, what's lovely is that she sails back up the river to Moscow, up the Volga. And it's on that riverboat journey that she hears the boatmen singing Russian and Ukrainian folk songs. And that's where she first develops a real interest in that kind of Russian folk music tradition. After she goes back to London, after having had 2 years in Russia, she would translate Ukrainian folk songs for one of the Russian newspapers in London.
During her first summer in Russia, she connects with Stepniak's sister-in-law, Praskovia, a doctor. She takes a trip with her to see what conditions are like.
It's summer. And I'm sure the mosquitoes were flying everywhere, making this trip, this journey that they took in a cart drawn by a horse to get to this region where they find people ill from tuberculosis, venereal disease, living in extreme filth, unable to care for themselves. And Praskovia, the doctor, goes, provides medication and care. Just by having gone with Praskovia, Ethel would have been in trouble with the law. But she went anyway. She was willing to risk anything to help the Russians in any way that she could.
Praskovia's husband, Vasily, is imprisoned in solitary confinement for his radical political activities. Ethel goes to the prison with a parcel of food every day.
She didn't know if it was ever passed on to him by the guards, but the point was that she brought it every single day until the day he was transported to Siberia, and that was the day she said, "I'm leaving, I'm going back to London."
Awakened by a sense of injustice and inequality, Ethel, or Lily Boole, returns to England. Her experiences with revolutionaries is infused into her later novels, and her Russian trip proves instrumental in her personal life. In London, she becomes more deeply involved in the Russian emigres' publications. This brings us back, in a roundabout way, to that Easter Sunday in Warsaw, when she looked up at the Citadel housing prisoners. The man looking down from the prison was Wilfried Voynich.
He was a political prisoner being held there. His partners in this crime were hanged, and what they did was they put Wilfried Voynich in a cell facing the gallows so he could watch them die.
Wilfried himself is sent to Siberia.
And who does he meet in Siberia but Praskovia and her husband, Vasily? They convince him that he's got to escape from Siberia. She writes Stepniak's name and address on a scrap of paper, along with the name Lily Boole, and gives it to him and says, "If you make it, go to these people. They will help you." So Voynich manages to escape twice. He's caught both times.
It's only on his third attempt that he manages to escape. He makes his way to Mongolia, joins a caravan and spends months wandering with them until they reach Peking.
From there, he somehow makes his way to Hamburg, Germany, where he sells his coat and his glasses so he can buy some herring and bread and pay for a third-class ticket to England. It's a treacherous journey. One of the boats that he was on ran aground, lost its cargo. So he arrives on the London docks. You can imagine what he looks like. He's travel weary. He hasn't got his glasses. He can't see. He's hungry. He's dirty. He speaks no English. He has this scrap of paper in his hand. And he's walking along and he's showing it to passersby. And he comes across a young Jewish student who reads Russian. And he looks at the paper. He actually brings him directly to Stepniak. And when he gets there, Stepniak gets him cleaned up, gives him some of his own ill-fitting clothes, and he's introduced to this woman, Ethel Boole. Well, Lily Boole. And he looks, "Haven't I seen you somewhere before?" In Russian, of course. "And weren't you standing outside the Citadel at around Easter?" And she says, "Yes, I was." And that's how they actually met. And of course, they shared the common bond of their total commitment to helping the Russian people.
It's an almost unbelievable story.
It is almost unbelievable. And you wonder how true this really was. I think it was. And she was that outstanding a figure, I think, that you wouldn't forget. Somebody dressed in black with, you know, golden hair in the most desolate of settings. Of course people are going to remember her. And he did. Haven't I seen you somewhere before?
I saw you from my citadel prison room. I saw you.
Ethel and Wilfred work with Stepniak and other dissidents to print, translate, and send revolutionary literature to Russia. By 1895, Ethel adopts Wilfred's surname Voynich, and they live together as though married. But their work with the Russia Free Press and Stepniak comes to a sudden end when Stepniak dies.
It was a habit he had of reading books while he walked, and he was walking quite near his home, and he walked onto a level crossing and was hit by a train and died, I think, instantly. And very strangely, it seems that both Lily and Wilfred Voynich lost all interest in politics almost overnight when Stepniak died, and everything stopped. And by then, Wilfred had already told Stepniak, "I'm sorry, but Lily won't be able to help you with the translations for a while yet because she's writing a novel." And that was, of course, The Gadfly.
Throughout her life, Ethel writes 6 books and translates others, including Chopin's Letters. But her most significant is The Gadfly.
The Gadfly, this novel that is probably the reason we still remember Ethel's name today, was nothing to do with socialism at all, but it contained a number of themes that were really appealing to socialist and communist thinkers in the late 19th, early 20th century, and indeed up to the present day. So it's set in the 1840s, Italian Risorgimento, which is the period kind of coming up to Italian unification. It had been a lot of little separate kingdoms, and then it comes together as one country. And what the book does is combine this kind of heroic revolutionary idealism and anti-clericalism. So there are two big themes that appeal to radical thinkers in the 19th and 20th century.
Anatoly Krudayevitsky is a Russian-born writer and an editor for Honeycomb Press. They've republished The Gadfly in digital form.
I said the Russians were obsessed with the idea of revolution and, you know, righting all the world's wrongs. And maybe they somehow corresponded with this idea, because in Russian schools, this novel, The Gadfly, is on the curriculum. So I had to actually read it. And I really liked it.
The novel opens with the main character, Arthur, in conversation with a priest, Montanelli. They have a very close relationship.
Arthur sat in the library of the theological seminary at Pisa, looking through a pile of manuscript sermons. It was a hot evening in June, and the windows stood wide open, with the shutters half closed for coolness. The father director, Canon Montanelli, paused a moment in his writing to glance lovingly at the black head bent over the papers. When he spoke to Arthur, its note was always that of a caress.
Ava Welsh is an author and the director of creative writing in University College Cork.
Hi, how are you?
Hey there,
you're
busy.
No, come on in.
Incidentally, the library in the university is named the Boole Library after Ethel's father.
Where I got my copy of The Gadfly yesterday.
Ava tells me about the plot of the novel, which starts out with a merchant family in Italy.
So they're kind of colonials, first of all, and Arthur, of course, the central character, is the son of a merchant family, the Burton family. But in fact, because his mother is Catholic, he's different. So he's part of a kind of exiled caste, an elite, I suppose, a merchant elite, maybe like the Anglo-Irish or something. Arthur is a revolutionary, partly because he's young, partly because he's in love. As Voynich creates Arthur, he's a naive innocent who is betrayed by the evil that is Catholicism. And at the centre of the novel is the kind of choice between are you a good Catholic or are you a good human being? But it gets much more dangerous than that. I mean, it's a profoundly anti-Catholic novel, which I presume is why it was so popular in Russia.
Padre, come away with us. What have you to do with this dead world of priests and idols? They are full of the dust of bygone ages. They are rotten. They are pestilent and foul. Come out of this plague-stricken church. Come away with us into the light. Padre, it is we that are life and youth. It is we that are the everlasting springtime. It is we that are the future. Padre, the dawn is close upon us. Will you miss your part in the sunrise?
His own Catholicism, his own faith, and his connection to the priest who takes care of him and who's his sort of confessor is in fact the seeds of his betrayal. It's a novel that really wants to explode the idea of doctrine and the idea of faith. The real evil at the centre of the novel is the demands of the Catholic Church on the cardinal and the betrayal that he has to make.
So the book is published in 1897. She's worked on it for a few years. She's done research in the Italian archives and so on. And what the book does is tell the story of an international agent called Arthur Burton. And within a year of its publication, it's translated into Russian.
The Gadfly features a young couple. Gemma is sort of in love with a childhood sweetheart, Arthur. But he is revolutionary on the quiet, as is Gemma. And by oversight almost, Gemma believes that he's sold out the revolutionaries and he disappears, pretends to be dead, but actually escapes to South America, leaving his clothes, you know, where everyone could see that he's presumably drowned.
What is it you want?
I want to get away from here.
Aha, stowaway, huh? Want me to hide you? Been up to something, I suppose. Stuck a knife into somebody, eh?
What vessel do you belong to?
Carlotta Leghorn to Buenos Aires. She's over there,
pointing in the direction of the breakwater.
Beastly old hulk.
Buenos Aires, yes. Can you hide me anywhere on board?
He goes to South America, and what he endures there, to some degree, Vonage is really implying that he has been utterly degraded. At one point, it's the idea that he's been the slave of all the slaves. So he's lived the lowest of the low.
When he returns, he's a rabid revolutionary. And nobody recognises him.
Now, with a scar down one cheek, a limp, and unbelievably unrecognisable to Gemma or anybody else, and sets about becoming the scourge of Austrian authorities.
And he participates in the Italian uprising of 1848. In 1848, there was a whole spate of rebellions and uprisings all around Europe.
And it was called the Gadfly, because he stung, he made people jump. He was a nuisance, but very witty and sarcastic, wrote lots of good pamphlets, revered by the revolutionaries.
Well, I liked him, you know. He was a very hardened person. He was one of the first investigative journalists portrayed in a novel. He wrote things that the establishment didn't like. But he's very straightforward, you know. I like it about him. You know, he's not like an English gentleman who can talk his way around everything without making any enemies. You know, he called the spade. I like it about him.
He limped across the terrace to fetch a chair for her. The light from a window was shining full on his face, and she was able to study it at her leisure. She was disappointed. The forehead and left cheek were terribly disfigured by the long, crooked scar of the old saber cut. When he began to stammer in speaking, that side of his face was affected with a nervous twitch. But for these defects, he would have been, in a certain restless and uncomfortable way, rather handsome. But it was not an attractive face.
Something nasty has happened to the Gadfly. It's the melodramatic quality of the novel that we can see very little link between the Arthur and the Gadfly, that what he gets turned into is monstrous.
And does he get his revenge?
He doesn't really know. I mean, not to give away the plot, frankly, everybody is destroyed by what happens. And so what Vonage tears down is the ritual of Catholic belief and its perhaps pomp and wealth.
What was that oozing from the wafer, dripping down between the points of the golden sun, down onto his white robe? What had he seen dripping down, dripping from a lifted hand? The grass in the courtyard was trampled and red, all red. There was so much blood. It was trickling down the cheek and dripping from the pierced right hand and gushing in a hot red torrent from the wounded side. Even a lock of the hair was dabbled in it, the hair that lay all wet and matted on the forehead. Ah, that was the death sweat. It came from the horrible pain. The voices of the choristers rose higher, triumphantly.
Here is Pamela Blevins again.
It's really a very visceral, brutal book. In fact, a critic writing about The Gadfly later said, Mrs. Voynich evidently has something of an obsession with physical pain, disease, torture, and mutilation, because these occur in her books with a frequency for which there is not always artistic justification. A rather ghoulish tendency to hover over descriptions of the extremes of physical agony. And Ethel would later say, all of my books are about mental shock.
I mean, on one level, it's a very dark novel. It's really the unleashing of a kind of hell, isn't it? Where everything is tumbled down. But then again, you see, she was living in worlds where men and women were locked up. You know, suffragettes were force-fed. You know, people were physically restrained. People were being tortured and murdered. It's the world she lived in. And so there is a realism to that.
She knew what it was like to be part of a transnational political movement that had little factions all over the place, and that was evading capture by the police, and the sorts of kind of underground activity and how you needed to operate. So she had lived experience of the sorts of things that's described in the novel, and I'm sure that that's part of what gives the novel such great life and why it was such a convincing story. So the book itself has become so important in the 130-140 odd years since it was published that it's taken as an accurate description of what life was like in Italy in 1848, and the book is just that influential.
So she sets this novel in Italy, but really, is she talking about Russia?
I think it's a way of talking about Russia, but she obviously wants to equate Catholic belief with all of the ideologies that hold back the socialist revolution. And yeah, you can see why it was so popular in Russia. It plays to the idea of heroic revolution and the crippling hand of Orthodox religion.
And for all its seriousness, it's also quite amusing that no one recognises him.
I mean, what you're thinking about all the people around him, you're thinking, at what point is the penny going to drop to any of them? You know what I mean? How bright are these people? They knew this guy all his life. It seems to take them an awful long time. But then I think it's the conventions of melodrama. What we're dealing with is not a realist novel. I don't think this is a novel of psychological depth. I think it's a novel of kind of, what would you call it, intense melodramatic grand passions. Actually, I think it's an opera.
The Gadfly gains a certain popularity. George Bernard Shaw writes an adaptation for the stage, though it's never produced. A few editions of the novel are published in English. But Ethel won't know for a number of decades just how popular it had become. During her lifetime, The Gadfly sells millions of copies in China and the Soviet Union. It's printed in more than 100 editions in 22 languages there. The Russians rank Voynich alongside Charles Dickens and Mark Twain, adapted for three operas and two films, one with a score by Dmitri Shostakovich. His famous Gadfly suite is inspired by it, including this well-known section, Romance. Shostakovich's Romance, inspired by Cork-born writer Ethel Voynich and her most famous novel, The Gadfly. This music was also adapted as the theme tune for a popular 1980s BBC TV series, with the actor Sam Neill as Riley, Ace of Spies. The series was inspired by the infamous Cold War spy called Sidney Rosenblum, better known as Riley. In fact, Ethel knew the actual spy Riley. But the question was, how well? Did she have an affair with him? And did she base her novel, The Gadfly, on his life?
Sidney Riley, the Ace of Spies, was an arch spy and led the most incredibly devious life. He was born in Odessa and then allied himself and sort of rent a spy with whoever would pay.
Now, he was obviously a bit of a character. He was supposed to have had 11 passports and it said a wife to accompany each passport.
A chameleon. Many disguises, many personalities. One of the stories that he told was that he met Ethel and, of course, they went to Florence, Italy, and they had a wild affair, and he spilled out the story of his life, upon which she allegedly based the plot for her famous novel, The Gadfly.
Some people think that Riley was actually the prototype of Arthur Burton, the main protagonist from the novel, but I doubt it because it's a completely different personality. He was working for MI5 and they told him investigate those two revolutionaries, Voynich and Stepniak, and so he did. But the thing is, they all clustered together, you know, in Paris and London. They all knew each other.
He had said that he was actually the model for the Gadfly, which, of course, was hugely damning and blasphemous to the Soviets because it meant that their folk hero, the revolutionary, the gunrunner, the party man, actually was modelled on a very scurrilous character. The relevance of that, in a way, to much later times was that, as part of the Cold War, basically a Western project, to anything to discredit what the Soviets considered to be fundamental and important to their culture. The press was full of it all, because it was just, you know, cooking snooks of the Soviet Union.
Alana Hopkin feels that Riley may have made up this story when he was asked about his history.
Riley, in 1928, I think it was, when he was much older, he was asked about his background, and the story he gave was the story of the Gadfly, which he borrowed because he knew the book and he liked it. He was a liar. He was a well-known liar.
Jerry Kennedy is a descendant of Ethel's. He came across a copy of a photograph taken in Florence, Italy, in 1895.
Looking very sweet and, unlike her normal self, quite sexually attractive, looking erotic. On the back of it was the legend in her handwriting, the Gadfly's mother to the Gadfly's father from the Gadfly's country, which we assume is the Gadfly's mother being Ethel, that she wrote the book. The Gadfly's father being the fact that he was the subject of it. He inspired it all. He was the main character in it, in the Gadfly's country, which of course was Italy. So that seemed to indicate that the liaison actually had happened between them. And although the Soviets denied it and denied it, you know, total calumny, and obviously shocked deeply at this idea, I discovered actually that it probably was true.
Pamela Blevins disagrees.
Yes, she might have gone to Florence, to Italy, with Sidney, but, you know, he was 10 years younger, for one thing. So, you know, had he lived this extraordinary life that's portrayed in this book when he was only 22 years old or something like that? No, I don't think he did. But he claims that he did. And I think what happened is that he took the facts of his life, facts with quotation marks around the word, of his life from Ethel Voynich's writings. Not just The Gadfly, but later works.
So the popular idea is that she went off, had an affair, and based the character Arthur Burton on Riley. But in actual fact, it was maybe the other way around?
I think it was the other way around. Because she conceived the idea for this novel when Sidney Riley would have been 12 years old. So he hasn't had all of these extraordinary adventures that Arthur Burton in The Gadfly has. He eventually had adventures later. You know, he plotted a fictionalized version of his life, I think. But he was a dangerous kind of character. And sort of typical, I think, of some of the people that were the Voyniches were getting involved with. Where is Ethel? I don't know. Only Ethel knows. And we can't ask her.
Ethel didn't comment on the rumors. But when I was talking to historian Angela Byrne, I wondered, was this really in Ethel's character?
A lot of reports say that she was quite a cold and kind of unromantic, not a warm woman. Mm. So how does that tie in with the notion of her sort of having an extracurricular romance?
Yeah, I mean, I guess everyone's got the potential to have the flame lit inside them, and especially someone who's so daring politically and personally in the sort of activities and the sorts of people that she's around. And I think as well, sometimes when women who are daring in public life are described as cold or unfeeling, that's kind of the patriarchy at work, and it's to diminish their humanity, and it's to try and say, look, a quote-unquote real woman who should be tender and loving wouldn't be at these sorts of political activities.
Having left Italy and Riley behind, we know that Ethel and Wilfred Voynich marry. And during their marriage, they unofficially adopt a daughter, Winifred Eisenhart. Wilfred travels to New York in 1914 and continues with his rare book business. Ethel doesn't follow immediately, but works as a social worker for the Quakers throughout the First World War. In 1920, she emigrates to New York to join Wilfred and his business partner, Anne Neal. From the time she moves to New York, Ethel turns her efforts to music and all but abandons writing. Wilfred is trading in manuscripts, and on a European trip just before the war, he buys one that comes to be named after him. René Zandberg is one of the world authorities on the Voynich manuscript.
The Voynich manuscript deals with several topics. While we cannot read the text, we can still guess what it's about because it's heavily illustrated. Every page basically has illustrations. The document starts off with a section with plant drawings, so it looks like a herbal book. Then there's a section with zodiac signs. There's a section with stars and cosmological drawings. There's another section which people call biological or balneological, which has drawings of small women in tubs and systems of pipes, which is very difficult to understand. Then there is another section with very small plant drawings and containers, which look like they contain recipes for medicine. And finally, there's a larger text section which has no drawings except for small stars in the margin. People call this the recipe section. Interestingly, if this is a manuscript in cipher, it must have been written about 600 years ago, and ciphers were not very complicated in those days. So it looks as if deciphering this manuscript should be fairly easy, but the text doesn't behave like normal language. It seems to have words, but the patterns in the words is unusual, so it doesn't look like normal language. People have tried and failed completely. All methods have failed for over 600 years, which is quite remarkable.
Desmond MacHale is professor of mathematics in University College Cork.
It's very artistic, it's very beautiful, but what's it about? What's it got to reveal? I mean, is it sort of religious? Is it artistic? To give meaning to something like that is very, very difficult. It may be just a dream, verging on a nightmare.
Wilfred Voynich acquired the book as part of a collection of some 30 manuscripts, but this one immediately took a special place for him.
Wilfred hoped that he or someone else would decipher the manuscript and was convinced that once the contents of the book was understood, that the value would increase.
Nowadays, this is understood differently. The value of the book is precisely that nobody can read it.
When Wilfred Voynich bought this manuscript, along with the collection it came with, a condition was that he wouldn't divulge where he acquired them, as there was a risk that the manuscripts could be confiscated by the Italian authorities.
So he had to invent some cover story where he got it. So he explained that he found it in some chests of which the owners didn't know what they contained, and then he got the right to sell them. Now, this wasn't true. He told his wife privately and in confidence where he got this manuscript. So she then also decided that this knowledge should not be lost, and she wrote it down in a letter to be opened after her own death, which happened another 30 years later. So from this, we know a little bit where Voynich got the book, but not exactly. So we don't have the complete story, and we're still finding out important details about that sale.
There are many different theories about the origin of the Voynich manuscript, including that Wilfrid himself forged it.
Now this we can safely exclude. If it was a forgery, it would have been made around 1900, and the technology in those days was simply not good enough to be able to fool the modern techniques that exist in analysing these manuscripts.
I think the sort of jury is out on it. It could be a gigantic hoax. If it is a hoax, it's an extremely good hoax. It's the best hoax ever perpetrated. I mean, there have been some marvellous hoaxes in history, but they've been discovered. You know, I mean, you look at the paper, you look at the ink, and you look at the binding, and I suspect it's a work of art.
And there are many signs that the manuscript is genuinely old. In particular, the binding has been studied, so the way it has been sewed onto strings, etc., has been studied in great detail by manuscript conservators, and it is genuinely old. Also, the materials have been tested, and any kind of fake would immediately fall through by these tests. So a typical example is, for example, that the manuscript doesn't have any yellow colors. And this is because the yellow colors have faded. So it's a yellow that is 100 years old, and over the years it has faded. It's a natural type of pigment. It's one of many pieces of evidence that the manuscript is genuinely old, definitely.
In general, in mathematics, once a problem is solved, it loses interest. It's the unsolved problems that are really very interesting, and people keep looking and looking and looking at them all the time. It's the very fact that we don't know. I mean, it's the only really unsolved problem in that sort of area. I mean, nearly everything else has been cracked, you know. I mean, there's nothing else like it anywhere. It's unique.
People want to know what it says. Nowadays, people don't accept mysteries. They have to be solved. And this, even though it looks like it should be easy, it is an unsolvable mystery so far. There are always new people getting excited about it and coming up with solutions that, unfortunately, aren't very realistic. But it's the mystery that that attracts people. Ethel certainly had an interest for the Voynich manuscript herself. After Voynich died, she actually spent some time in trying to understand it. She was very interested in the plant drawings, and she communicated with many people, and she collected her own list of possible plant identifications. There are notebooks written by her which are full of such lists. They have been preserved. And of course, she tried to sell it together with her secretary, Anne Nill, but they also never managed to sell it until after her own death, in fact.
After Wilfrid Voynich dies in 1930, his longtime business associate, Anne Neal, became Ethel's companion. The two women lived together for 30 years in an apartment in Manhattan, where Ethel continued to compose. Through her later years, she composed numerous scores, which are now in the collection of the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. Pamela Blevins came across this unsorted archive a number of years ago. I got a chance to go through them with her.
Let's see. That's box one, is it?
Okay. One Saturday morning, I was in here with a friend, and we were doing some research on an American violinist. And while we were waiting for the material to be delivered, I began to think about Ethel Voynich, and I remembered from her will, of which I have a copy, that she wanted her music collection donated to the Library of Congress. These are her manuscripts, so this is an original manuscript from Bunny Dance. So I requested to see the collection, and the next week they had delivered all three huge boxes of Ethel Voynich's music manuscripts.
It's another vocal work, Come Near. It looks like French and English.
And I started to go through the boxes, and it was like opening a treasure chest, because I don't think anybody had seen them since 1961.
Let's see what else is here.
You were essentially cataloguing this for the first time.
Well, yes, I was going through it for the first time with some seriousness, and eventually, you know, in correspondence with the library and so forth, they ultimately did catalog the entire collection. Jerusalem. This, I think, she thought of as her really great piece. This is a copy of Ethel Voynich's outline for her oratorio, Jerusalem, called, on this particular piece of paper, The New Jerusalem. And the text is from around 1600, and it's by Anonymous. And she wrote it on stationery from the Commodore Hotel at 42nd Street and Lexington Avenue in New York City near Grand Central Station. So we have the chorale, the quartet, the chorale fugue, chorus, and Jerusalem, My Happy Home. You know, again, it's interesting because here we have a woman who's, you know, been raised Catholic, apparently, but is pretty much atheistic in her viewpoint, and she's writing liturgical and religious music. It's very neat. It's very neat. Violas, cello. So she's, you know, she's got a full orchestra playing the prelude. This seems to be a work that she thought highly of. You know, you can see the age of the paper and the kind of pen that she used, pen dipped in ink. It's like touching the past and bringing the past into the present and a personal connection. You can touch a piece of paper where her hand moved across it with a pen. That's what it feels like. And yeah, it's moving in its way. And what I find interesting about her music is that it was shown back in 1967 to the conductor, Raymond Lepage, and he looked at it and he thought it was very simple and not expertly written, but I don't know what he had seen. It could have been a motet. I don't think it was one of the larger works. Then he went on to say that she was possibly more talented than Ethel Smith. Well, that's kind of a compliment because Ethel Smith's music has absolutely taken off, and Ethel Smith was very talented. She was gifted, no question about it. Ann Neill felt that Ethel would become as well-known, that her genius in music would be recognized someday, as well as her genius as a writer. And I don't know if that day is going to come.
The archives in the Library of Congress hold boxes and boxes of scores by Ethel, including a cantata dedicated to the memory of Roger Casement. It originally commemorated the leaders of the 1916 Rising. And although her writing is less well known in Ireland now, the Gadfly was popular amongst Irish Republicans. But I have taken a copy of one of Ethel's favourite pieces, a prelude to Jerusalem, that Pamela Blevins unearthed in Ethel's archive.
How are you?
You well, nice.
Back in Ireland, I've come along to the Royal Irish Academy of Music in Dublin, a setting that Ethel herself might feel very comfortable in, having spent years studying music. I'm here to meet composer and conductor Andrew Sinnott. He's taken Ethel's score and input it into some composition software to get a sense of how it might sound. First, though, I asked him what he knew of Ethel Voynich before I sent him the score.
I knew absolutely nothing. So I'd never even heard her name, and which seems amazing now that I've done a little bit of reading about her. There's no presence in Ireland for her output, as far as I can kind of detect.
So when I sent you this score, what did you do with it?
I took the orchestral parts, so it's scored for full orchestra, so that's a full string section, and brass, and woodwinds, and it's just a standard orchestra size. And so I put them into a program called Sibelius, which is a music notation program. And I did that, and to me, the music, you know, she's obviously a very good musician. There's nothing that sticks out. So quite often when you have inexperienced or if you're in any way an amateur, there can be things that stick out that they kind of give you away. There are none of those things in the music that I heard.
This music is the prelude to Ethel Voynich's Jerusalem.
Thank you.
I mean, stylistically, it would not seem out of place in the middle of the 19th century. And that's, so considering that she wrote it well into the 20th century, it's old-fashioned. And the type of music it is, it's kind of a, has a Germanic romantic feel to it, I suppose. It's lush, she's not afraid of putting lots of instruments together and giving them kind of climactic moments, and she's able to deliver that. So clearly she's a musician of great competence. I would say that it perhaps, if there's anything negative you can say about it, it kind of lacks inspiration. And what I mean about that is that there are no flights of fancy in it at all. It takes itself very seriously. She tends to layer things on top of repeating patterns. So like a bass line of, say, two or three notes that would repeat over and over again. And she gradually adds things to that, changes the voicings above it just to create the piece. And she does that in the first two movements. The second movement, which is the chorale, is more complex because there's a melody that's sung.
Having looked at this score and now we have a little sense of how it sounds, do you think that Ethel Vonage deserves to be re-evaluated?
What it does display, those few pages, display her competence and ability as a musician.
It feels as though the word competent when you're describing a musician is possibly the worst thing you could be called, is competent. You want to be given more than that if your heart is set on it.
Well, competence is the entry-level requirement. I mean, if you're not competent, then you may as well not. Certainly, you won't be making your living doing it. Competence is what everybody looks for, and so it's not. Competence is not an insult at all. It's really a compliment. It's just not the highest compliment you can pay to a composer.
I get the sense that Ethel would be disappointed with Andrew Sinnott's evaluation of her composition. I'm disappointed for her. But perhaps in time, a few gems will emerge from her archive. She certainly didn't receive much acclaim for her composition in her lifetime. And although she's not in print here in the country of her birth, her translated writing has had a much longer lasting effect, and one that she only learned about in her 90s.
Anatoly, when Ethel published The Gadfly, how quickly did she understand how popular it had become?
She didn't. She didn't know about the huge Russian editions of her book until when the Russian translator Yevgenia Taratuta visited her in New York. She lived in New York. She was an old woman. She lived a very reclusive life. But Taratuta found her because she wrote a book about her. And many people in Russia thought that Voynich was long dead because, you know, The Gadfly was published in 97, her latest book, her last novel, in 1945, Put Off Thy Shoes, an excellent book, by the way. She found her little flat in upstate New York and she visited her. And she told her that, you know, you've published millions of copies of your novel in Russia. Not only that all her novels were published, all of them, translated into Russian very accurately and published. She was astonished. She didn't believe her.
During the Cold War, there was so little contact with those behind the Iron Curtain in the East. The extent of Voynich's fame was unknown to her and the West.
And then Taratuta contacted the American ambassador to Russia, Adlai Stevenson. Adlai Stevenson went to talk with Khrushchev about Voynich and the fact that she's not getting a penny. She wasn't poor, but she wasn't very well off, you know, living in a small flat in New York, not seeing a penny of the royalties which were due to her. And Khrushchev, he was about to become Secretary General of the Communist Party, But he signed the permission for the Russian Authors Fund to pay $15,000 to Ethel Voynich.
There is a short black and white silent Pathé film of Ethel in her 90s, just a few years before she died in 1960. In the film, a Russian delegation visit her to commend her on her significance to the Russian people. They're there to tell her that she's revered and her legacy would be that she is the most popular translated writer in Russia. She's still in print there. Alana Hopkin and I watched the film.
This is her apartment block in Manhattan. They're looking up at her window. They get out of the car and they're looking up at her window. Now they're in her apartment. The principal ballerina of the Bolshoi, I'm giving her a huge bouquet of roses. And look at those eyes. You just see them for a minute.
That little flash of her eyes, she really does look happy.
Yes, she does. But she also looks very serious, doesn't she? So one of the men is a diplomat. He's giving her a piece of paper, check. She's reading it. It must have been just amazing.
The best-selling book, and I think it still is among translated novels. It was like, you know, you learn that you lived another life in another country. And you're very famous there. It's something unimaginable, isn't it?
Music, Mystery and Manuscripts was presented and produced by Zoe Commons, with sound mixing by Tin Pot Productions. The readings were by Declan Brennan. And that programme and a number of others are available to stream or podcast from Spotify, Apple Podcasts, the RTE Radio Player and the RTE website. There are a number of ways to find it, but the best is probably to search for the Lyric Feature Podcast.